actually walking around feeling kind of guilty and bad. I was supposed to do this event in New York and now I can't, but I went back and forth with this woman about literally 6 times, maybe more, telling her I can do it, I can't do it, I definitely can do it. I'm really sorry, I absolutely can't do it. Let's just say 100% I'm going to do it. And then, you know, yesterday I was finally like, I can't do it. And she wrote me back, clearly irritated, but, you know, polite. And it's just the biggest problem in my life. And my brother has this problem too. It's this shared inability to make a decision. In his case, I think, not so much anymore now that he's getting older, but to make a decision. In my case, just to know what the future can handle.
That was an excerpt from a podcast by the writer Sheila Hedy called Podcast with Raisins. She's put out 6 episodes over 5 years, sometimes with more than a year in between each one. She doesn't really publicize the show, so despite her widely read books, the podcast remains little known. There's no format, and each episode seems created improvisationally, as if Hedy suddenly had the idea to record an episode while walking down the street and then posted the results unedited. This is sort of how her writing feels, like an intimate, casual conversation energized by raw curiosity. I met Hedy when we both started editing the interviews for the Believer magazine together in 2008. She'd just published an extraordinary talk with the art critic Dave Hickey, who just recently passed away. During this period, we were in a kind of ongoing conversation about the nature of dialogue, culture, art, and publishing. It's been one of my most fulfilling collaborative relationships so far. This was also around the time I was introduced to Sheila's writing. She was just releasing her book called How Should a Person Be, which was a novel unlike any other I'd read, folding memoir, playwriting, interviews, and a variety of other forms into its own self-aware narrative. But with every publication, before and after this book, Hedy has pivoted. She's always interrogating the role of the writer, the book, and exploring the whole spectrum of literature. She's written a collection of contemporary fables, a novella about an 18th century biographer, a compendium of her friend's philosophical provocations, a collaborative book about women's fashion, a children's picture book, a play, and an examination of the expectation of women to be mothers. Her upcoming book, Pure Color, is an altogether different kind of book than her last few. And yet, like all her work, it shares the same fundamental interest in human thought, in the nature of being an artist in the world. Recently, Sheila's begun teaching independent classes that share her philosophy and experiments as an artist. In this way, I've always seen her as a kind of philosopher. So when I saw that her publisher used this word to describe her, I had to ask her how she felt about the term.
Well, I've had more and more people say it to me over the last few years, I guess since motherhood. They're like, well, you're more of a philosopher than a novelist or something. And I mean, to me, that's just like almost too, like, to me, that I like that comparison. That's very flattering. I love reading philosophy. I don't think that I'm a philosopher in any academic sense, you know, but I do think, like what you say, I think about my books, they probably are animated more by thinking about thinking than trying to tell a story. So in that sense, I think that it's a useful category to invoke, because otherwise people read the books and they're not getting what they wanted or they expected, you know? So I think if you say that these books are philosophical, then people that are interested in thinking about thinking would be more drawn to them, you know? I mean, I wouldn't say I'm a philosopher. But then there's some like way in which philosophers now are academics, you know, they come up in the academy and they're the ones who are permitted to have that designation because they're thinking about what other philosophers have thought. But like, can you be a philosopher if you're not if you're not an academic who's thinking and working in a very like granular way on other what other philosophers have thought, like why can't it be a sort of more humble word, philosopher, than something, you know, degreed? Like, can it be a more playful word or just like a more descriptive word of the kind of thinking that you're doing or the kind of writing that you're doing? Right?
Yeah.
You wouldn't want to like water it down too much. Like the way, you remember like the word curator used to just be for people that worked in art museums, and now everything's curated. Like, but I think that's nice if regular people can, if the word is not just reserved for academics, perhaps that might be, maybe that like, if that word is a little looser, that it allows more people to think that they can also think about thought.
Yeah, and a curator is interesting because from my sense of it, it started in a more institutionalized place and then has become more open. Whereas philosopher, you know, if you look to the Greeks, And to the original,
started in an open place.
Yeah, right. It just started with non-academics, just almost talking in a more, seemed like more self-help sort of way, just publicly talking to people. And then the term almost now means something that isn't available to the average person.
Right. Well, and that's true of writing too. Like the number of people that feel like they have to get creative writing MFAs just baffles me. Like, why do you think that this is something you need to do in an academic sense? Like, writing is just something people, you know, it's not, it you know, it's any, why do you need a degree to write? Like, it just doesn't make any sense to me. Like, you were writing stories when you were 12 years old, you know? Or one writes their stories when they're 5 years old. Like, why does it have to become... Why does it have to be sort of conferred on you?
Yeah, I mean, to be a writer, all you need to do is write. To be a philosopher, all you need to do is love wisdom, right? 'Cause that's what it means.
Yeah.
And also, I went to, you know, I got an MFA. I also studied jazz in college, which is its own bizarre irony that something so far outside of the institution has become so deeply institutionalized, you know?
Well, maybe that's true about literature too. Like the way that it's taught has become more about conservation than experimentation. I mean, I know the way you teach is about experimentation, but I think in general, like the idea of the writing workshop is about conservation, like conserving a certain type of maybe particularly American storytelling. And like reifying it or passing it on or, you know, encouraging people to follow in that path.
Are you, with your teaching, to me it always feels like I'm learning from you. You seem like someone who's always learning. And so when I read your work or just talk to you, it feels like an experience of learning. Not that you're didactic in the way that you write. It's not like that. It's like being around, you know, love of wisdom, as it were, it gives you the energy of wanting to learn.
I do want there to be like space for the reader to think their own thoughts. Like that seems really important to me in the structure of the book. Like with motherhood, like I want the person who's reading the book to think about their own thoughts on the subject. So there's like formal choices that I make so that there's like room for them, rather than a book that thinks all the thoughts for you
Is that related to the distinction between fiction and nonfiction for you?
No, I think it's related to description, like the degree of description in a book. So I feel like if you have a lot of visual description in a book, it kind of traps you in the atmosphere of the book. Whereas if you don't have a lot of description, like in my books, then the person sort of stays on, their body is in their life. Like their body remains in their life, in their room. And like if your body is remaining in your own space, then you can think your own thoughts much more easily than if your body and mind are in some altered landscape that the writer has created.
Do you feel like that's your experience of reading a lot, that there are almost two parallel streams of thought, like that of the writers and your own?
Yeah. Yeah.
Rather than just being fully immersed in the writer's world, which is often the way that books are talked about, right?
Yeah. I mean, I like that experience. Like, I just read Pride and Prejudice. But I don't know. I mean, even Jane Austen, like, the way that she narrates, she accompanies you in your own, like, critiques of the characters, right? So it's immersive, but she also, like, you also step out of the narrative with her. I think that's, well, I'm trying to think about who doesn't let you, well, there's, like, just a lot of contemporary fiction I've read that where, yeah, they're writing a novel and there's no place for you alone. Like, you're not given a place to step out unless you put the book out. And there's no place where the writer steps out of it with you. I'm reviewing this woman, this Swedish writer, Lena Andersson, right now. And her books are all about, like, she's got a character and there's her as the narrator. And her first two books that were published in English were both about this woman who's kind of deluding herself in love. Like, they're both about relationships with men who kind of are giving her mixed signals. And the character is, like, constantly interpreting the signals to her own benefit, like, you know, so that she can preserve this illusion that they love her when they really don't. And Lena Andersson, like, as the writer, is always saying, like, there's this other way that she could, that this character Esther could be thinking about the situation, but she's not. And it's really interesting. Like, I've not seen a book do that, but that's like an example of a book I really love, because she's narrating your own skepticism of the character. And then you can step further outside that and be like, okay, well, here's the narrator's point of view and here's Esther's point of view and what's my point of view. Like, it kind of encourages you to do that third thing.
I know that the subject of the class that you're about to teach is how people read your work.
Well, it's actually just like one part of the course, but it's the part that I'm most excited about, because when I was teaching this last summer, or the summer that just passed, I came up with this exercise where you, let's say you're in a group of four people and you send the other three people the same, like, 300 word paragraph, let's say. So I've written a 300 word paragraph from my book and I really want to know what's being communicated, and I send it to those people. And the exercise is that what those people do is they just read one sentence at a time. They read the first sentence, like, all individually on their own. You send me your 300 words. I read the first sentence, and then I write down after that sentence, you know, like, in bold or in red or whatever, literally what I see in my head and, like, what I got from that sentence and what it made me think, and the whole scene I'm visualizing. Like, I could write 100 words or 200 words about what that first sentence does to me as a reader. And then I do that with the second sentence and the third sentence, reading one sentence at a time. And then the person gets back these three different versions of very granular descriptions of the thoughts that those readers had as they read the sentences. And when we did this exercise, and when people did it for me, it was shocking. Like, you have no idea how much is being communicated that you did not intend. It's exciting, you know? And it's also really interesting because, like, all three people will say completely different things. And you realize when you read a sentence how much comes into your head. Like, it's also fun to write that part. Like, you're like, oh, you know, the person's like, you know, Jenny walked into the room and saw her uncle sitting at the table. And, like, immediately you're like, you see the room, you know what her feeling is about the uncle, you make all these assumptions. And I just think it's useful. It's kind of bracing, like, to see how much is going on that has nothing to do with, or that's only, like, very mildly suggested by what you wrote. So I don't even know what one learns by that, but it's kind of amazing. It's like an amazing experience to read what people write, and also to write for other people and to see how much you're interpreting that you don't, that's just like, you're not even really conscious of how much interpreting you're doing, and, you know, when you're reading, or how much, like, creation you're doing.
Some artists will say to never think about that, right? Because for them, it's just paralyzing to realize, you know, as we were talking about before, that anything you said can be interpreted in millions of ways. And even going into the future, it could, you know, a benign word now can become a charged word later, or any of these kinds of interpretations. And so I definitely know artists who are fully on the side of, for example, never reading reviews of their work, never letting you know, someone come into their studio for a studio visit, never giving drafts to friends to read. But I know you're very much open to that. You like that you share drafts of your work with friends, and that's part of your process, almost this communal kind of thinking about writing at times.
Well, because, like, it's just true. Like, it's true that other people are going to interpret you differently from how you meant it. So I think, like, shutting out that knowledge is just a little silly. Like, if it's going to happen, if that's what art is something that everyone makes something different of, every audience member makes something different of, then why wouldn't you, why would you pretend that that's not the case? Why would you pretend that's not the case when you're making it? Like, the reason that I like to send my drafts to different people is because that's going to happen eventually when the book comes out, and it's useful for me to see it through different perspectives as I'm writing it. I can see the work from more dimensions, more vantage points. So if it's inevitable, why are you pretending that it's not inevitable?
Yeah, it comes down to this question of what art is. And I think in my life, I've come to the sense that art is communication, just fundamentally. Yeah. It's a transference of an energy. But I guess some people might feel that it's not that, that they could work privately without showing it to someone, and it's only a communication with themselves, and that the rest is irrelevant, that it's more of a therapeutic tool or a tool for inner exploration, but it isn't an external kind of communication for them.
Yeah, and they probably would not, they probably make their best art, they probably make better art by thinking about it that way, right? Like, you just have to figure out how are you, what process makes the best work for you. And so for some people, I'm sure it's not showing it to anyone, but for me it is.
Once you define art as communication, then you kind of decide what kind of communication it is. Is it a populist communication? Is it a communication for my group of friends? Is it for this demographic? Whatever it is. Do you get to that level where you start thinking about who is this for?
Yeah, but it's always different. Like, so with motherhood, like, I had, I don't know, a number of friends in mind, like 6 or 7 friends, and I thought, okay, I'm looking forward to them reading this book, and I want them to read this book, and I'm curious what they'll think of it, and I sort of had them in mind. But, like, they are stand-ins for the rest of the world, right? Like, I don't literally think they're the only people who are going to read the book, but they represent different, probably, perspectives, you know. And then there's everyone else that I don't need to think about because, well, I just don't. That's just too much thinking. Like, or with this last book, Pure Color. Well, with this book, Pure Color, like, it's less, I had less of a sense of the audience, I think. It really was more just, like, the struggle to write it, and the idea of thinking of an audience was maybe beyond me because I felt so separate from the world when I was writing it. But I think that can be a communication too, right? Even if you're not thinking about who you're communicating it to, that's communicating something. Like, if what I'm saying in this book in part is, like, the experience of grief separates you so much from other people, you're almost like on drugs, you're having your own private experience, that's still, so that's a communication. Like, I'm saying that this book could not be written for people, and that's communicating something about grief, like the way that it separates you from society.
In that case, when there's less of a expectation of an audience, is it safer to release something? I mean, in the example you gave of motherhood, say you give that book to these 6 or 7 friends and they all dislike it. does it then feel like it failed to achieve that communication? Whereas a book like this, where you're writing to a more abstract kind of audience, maybe there's less of a possibility of failing to achieve that, right?
I think, like, in either case, when people didn't like motherhood, or, you know, the people that inevitably won't like this book or already have not liked this book, like, it doesn't feel more or less painful in one or the other case. Because you still, like, in either case, just hope people love it.
It's always the dream, right? That, at least for me, that by like, modulating your expectations well, you can protect yourself.
Do you feel very bad or hurt when people don't like what you've made?
I would say it's less about when people dislike it and more about when people ignore it or when people are unmoved in any direction by it.
Right. So when people don't like it, do you feel a kind of exhilaration or do you feel bad?
I enjoy that more. I feel exhilaration, yeah. I feel like it at least it got someone going.
I never feel that. I never feel exhilaration if someone doesn't like something. I wish I did. Like, to me, that's the avant-garde position, right? Like, you're excited to upset people. But if something about it rubs you wrong and sticks with you that it rubs you wrong, you tend not to say, like, this is a great work of art. Or maybe not you. I don't mean you. Actually, you might even say that. But, like, somebody else would not say, this is a very compelling work of art that has rubbed me the wrong way. They'll just say, this is shitty. This is not good. They don't usually accept that part of them likes it or is drawn to it or is activated by it. They do what they can to belittle and dismiss it.
I'm going to pause the conversation for a moment so we can listen to Sheila reading from her alphabetical diary. It's an unpublished, ongoing work in which she alphabetizes lines from her journals over the last 10 years. Like much of her writing, it's simultaneously a vulnerable depiction of her mind and a finely tuned conceptual project in which she abstracts herself into collage. Here's a bit from the I chapter.
I like Kierkegaard. I like looking at the mountain. I like Manet. I like my face still. I like my life and what I've created for myself. I like reading Amanda Filippacci. I like reading Andy Warhol. I like reading Gogol. I like reading interviews with Woody Allen. I like reading Jane Bowles. I like reading Kurt Vonnegut. I like reading Oscar Wilde. I like reading Paul Bowles. I like reading reviews in the NYRB of collections of essays put out by art critics. I like seeing the old women swimming. It makes being old seem not so bad. I like that he wants me and that he's so strange, strange like all my other friends, but in that extreme no culture way. That is, Pavel doesn't belong to any tribe you can pinpoint, but only his own, and is a complete nonconformist in the authentic way, in the way that makes everyone want to beat him up. I like that I do not have to take care of him, and I like how excited, desirous, loving, and adoring I feel toward him when I'm not feeling annoyed and hateful. I like the story of O. I like the way he smells. I love how it feels to hold him. I like how intelligent he is. I like his family. I love how he treats his friends. I like how good-looking he is. I like his balanced view of the world, his moral nature. And even if he can be an asshole at times, I really always love to hold and touch and smell him, to treasure him. I like the way the pastries are taken out of their dishes, put onto paper plates, and then wrapped in flour-covered wrapping paper with the sides tucked in and under. I like thinking, and I love tools for thinking or understanding. I like thinking. I like this apartment too much. It's my obvious home. I like this feeling of getting just a little bit fat. I like to take art slow, as slow as it needs.
It's interesting to read a diary that's where you've taken every sentence and alphabetized it so that it gives an impression of you as a person, but there's no specificity to a moment or a narrative. Instead, it's a more diffuse revealing of yourself.
I mean, I wanted to apply a scientific filter to what's not scientific. So, like, I mean, the what is revealed to you is different from what my intention was, because my intention in alphabetizing it was to learn my repetitions and to see, like, does anything change over 10 years? Like, if you write a diary for 10 years, like, I just wanted to know if I'd grown or if I'd stayed the same. And I don't know, I thought that that would be the way to learn the answer to that question, was to put all the sentences in alphabetical order. And I think I actually did learn the answer. I think I did learn the answer to the question, but not the way I thought. Like, what I was hoping for was to see, okay, like, 15 times over the last 10 years I wrote the sentence, I hated him, you know, or whatever. But of course, like, there weren't as many sentences repeated as I had imagined. But when you do break it down in this way, like, when you, like, as you say, when you sort of, like, detach the sentences from their work in creating a narrative, then you do see the trends of, like, okay, well, here are the things I think about. I think about whether I want to leave Toronto. I think about boyfriends. I think about, I wish I didn't think about boyfriends so much. You know, I think about how I'm going to finish my book. And you do, you're able to, like, make those categories and see in some way that, like, yeah, time does in some way not stand still, but, like, a personality has its, or character has its characteristic preoccupations. But I think that the, you know, I had an opportunity to publish it in 2013, and I still don't have, I mean, you said I'm going to publish it. I suppose I'll publish it eventually, but I don't have, like, a contract to publish it or anything like that, because I just don't know if I want to or should. But the thing that feels possible about publishing it is that I don't think that it is revealing in the way that if I published my diaries it would be revealing, because it is not a narrative. But I'd like to publish it as a book. I mean, I think that it's, like, a good modernist kind of thing to do as a book, you know? Like it's sort of a nice, like, Kenny Goldsmith type gesture, you know? I mean, I think, but not as banal. Like, and I feel like, because I've edited it a lot, I think that it's not as banal as it could be if it was a true, like, Kenny Goldsmith type of, like, exhaustive. It's not exhaustive. It's not all the sentences from 10 years.
Yeah, it certainly feels more readable than Kenny Goldsmith or, you know, certain extremely rigorous Oulipo exercises, yeah, or something.
Yeah. And that was, like, a question, and I don't know how you feel about it, but having read what I sent you, but, like, that was, or continues to be this ongoing question of, like, how much should it be, like, an Oulipo kind of, you have a constraint and then you just see it through, versus a novel which you edit to make it interesting for a reader. Like, what, and I think the reason that I've never published it and the reason that it doesn't ever feel like a true work of art to me is because I don't know how to settle that. I don't know where on the scale to be with this. Like, it doesn't really feel like it's on either end of the scale, so I don't really know if it works. I don't know what its rules are. And don't you think, like, the rules make you as the artist able to identify it as a work of art? But if you don't know what the rules are, it feels like it hasn't quite become that for you?
I do the same thing as you, where I create a kind of system and then I work within that. But whenever I come down to it, I realize that if I were to truly systematize everything, and the goal there would be, I can only imagine, an attempt at total control or total certainty, which I realize is not at all what I want in art. What I like is the tension between the two. So whenever I set up a system and I feel a moment arise where I want to break that system, I always do it. Because, one, I don't want to create a system in my mind and feel trapped in it. I think systems are tools that you should use fluidly and move between, or that I should, because I know personally, once something becomes overly systematized, I think that can become dangerous for many reasons on a, you know, personal level, cultural level, you know. And so for me, the most exciting thing is to see where a system is flawed and where it wants to be broken. Because any system is not going to satisfy everything. And I'm talking more broadly now. I mean, I'm talking about even like ideologies and religious systems and these kinds of systems that we live within. But I don't believe, for me at least, that I can ever find or create any system that will address everything. And since artworks are kind of little microcosms, I end up transferring that same philosophy into the artwork, you know, that I create the system and then at some point it crumbles and it's still in there and it helped me get going and it helped me define the work and feel grounded within it. But it wasn't ever able to trap me. And that's always a struggle.
That's
and
great.
I feel like that little struggle is for me the process a lot of the times, is making the system and then realizing that I didn't make a perfect system and there is no perfect system and it's flawed, and me coming to accept that. And that's sort of the whole arc of the artwork usually.
Yeah, that makes so much sense. And even what you're just saying, like, just I just get this like liberated feeling inside me. Like, that's such a nice way of thinking about it. You use it, but it would be like totalitarian to use only it and to expect it to want it to be the only form that it respects is this system. And in fact, no, there's like a multiplicity of systems. And in, you know, the same way that might be healthier in a society, that's probably also healthier in an artwork and for you, the artist. And you use them until you can't use, until they're no longer useful, until they start becoming too dangerous.
But that doesn't mean it was never useful or never good. It was a wonderful tool for a while,
right?
And it helped us all.
Yeah. And got you from here to there. It got you from A to B. And now how do you get from B to C? That's, you need something else. Like, that's culture, right? Like, so, you know, the way that feminism's aims change. Like, to insist that the aims of the 90s feminism are still the most important aims is like as foolish as what you were talking about doing in art. Like, okay, well, no, that got us from 1990 to 2000, but like now we need a different thing because the world is different, and we need like a different way of thinking about what freedoms we need.
Thanks for listening to Subject Object Verb, presented by Art Review. I'm your host and composer, Ross Simonini. If you want to learn more about Sheila Hetty's workshops, go to her website, SheilaHetty.com. As always, feel free to drop us a line at subjectobjectverb@artreview.com and send along one of your most intimate, revealing journal entries.